Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
And a very good morning to you on this Friday, the 8th of January. Welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, Ghanaians are divided over their government's decision to give sanctuary to two detainees from Guantanamo Bay.
I'm not quite sure why the government is doing this, why it should be harbouring such detainees at this time.
I'm scared because it's dangerous.
I think we should accept them because we also go for aid from other countries.
And we'll also be paying a visit to the border between Cameroon and Nigeria.
We have been conducting regular patrols in these areas, in the villages at the border, and the situation is stable. We have at times some sporadic incursion of Boko Haram members there.
Stay tuned to this edition of Africa Link.
Top story.
Two detainees from the US military base in Guantanamo Bay on Cuba have been released and sent to Ghana. The two men from Yemen who were captured in Afghanistan were accused of training with the terrorist network Al-Qaeda and fighting for the Taliban. Their release is part of efforts by the US government to reduce the number of low-level terrorist suspects in custody. The US won't send them back to Yemen because of instability there. But as Isaac Kelechi reports from Ghana, the decision to accept them there came after months of discussions and has met with misgivings.
Ghana's decision to accept a request by the United States government to take in two Guantanamo detainees has sparked a major controversy in the country. The U.S. has made assurances that the two detainees, both of Yemeni origin, have been cleared of any involvement in terrorist activities. But announcement of their release into Ghanaian society has raised eyebrow about the dangers posed by the two men. Emmanuel Bensa, an analyst on West African affairs, says Ghana's government made a wrong decision.
We go and take on the issue of Guantanamo Bay ex-detainees, which is an even larger problem stemming from the 9/11 attacks. And I'm not quite sure why the government is doing this at a time, you know, especially when we have elections, especially when security issues are at the fore.
But Izuechi Nwosu, an analyst on security issues in Africa, thinks the Yemenis do not pose a danger to Ghana because they have undergone enhanced scrutiny under the Americans.
If the American government that arrested these people have come to the conclusion that they are not guilty, they've not found any incriminating evidence against them, they've done their background checks and they are freeing them. But for certain reasons, they don't want to send them back to their countries of origin and they're now distributing them to friendly countries. Fair enough. But then the receiving countries also have a responsibility to do their own checks because they are the ones receiving these people who are now going to be set free.
Many Ghanaians are furious about these government decisions, but a few things Ghana should help.
I'm scared because it's dangerous, because we don't know what they are coming to do. If they come here, they can bring a lot of things in the town.
I think we should accept them because we also go for aid from other countries. So if they need help from Ghana, we can also help them.
Guantanamo Bay is a maximum security center. So consider somebody who's been kept in a maximum security center being released, whether confirmed or otherwise, having links to terrorist group and coming to Ghana. I think it's a major cause for concern.
The two Yemenis are being released into Ghana around the same time that the government is opening its doors to another set of refugees. The International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, ICTR, also made a request to resettle some of its convicted prisoners to Ghana. The convicts, according to the ICTR, have served their sentences, but the climate in Rwanda is not appropriate to resettle them there. Additionally, Ghana is now allowing Syrians already residing in the country to resettle their relatives who have been displaced by the conflict. The government has said it is not reversing its decision in spite of the number of public criticisms. Foreign Affairs Minister Hanatete is expected to meet lawmakers to provide further clarification while the debate of whether to accept the Guantanamo inmates rages on local radio stations.
Isaac Kelechi in Accra. Now, the Guantanamo Detention Center has been housing terrorist suspects since shortly after the terrorist attacks on the United States on the 11th of September 2001. President Barack Obama promised to close it in 2009, but his efforts have been thwarted by Congress. Rob Freer is a researcher with the rights group Amnesty International in London, and I asked him if he believed that Obama was now making good on his promise to close Guantanamo.
Well, you know, it has to be said, it remains to be seen. I mean, you mentioned that he signed an executive order in 2009. He, at that point, committed his administration to close it by January 2010 at the latest. Clearly, there has been an abject policy failure here. And even though there have been, you know, further transfers during this recent period, we're still left with more than 100 men there, most of whom are held without charge. And the administration has manifestly failed to meet its human rights obligations, as has Congress.
Can you please remind us why those detainees whom the U.S. believes are guilty of crimes cannot be put on trial on U.S. territory?
Congress has objected to any transfers to the USA, whether it be for trial or release, which rather stymies any effort to close the facility quickly. But the administration has turned instead to military commission trials, which in our view do not meet international fair trial standards. But again, this has been a policy choice. The administration actually did announce in 2009 that six men would be transferred to the USA for trial in civilian federal court, and then backtracked when the heat got too much, the political heat got too much from Congress. I mean, I think it needs to be emphasized that while Congress has indeed failed to ensure that the USA meets its obligations, the administration has done its part to keep detainees where they are. You know, the Justice Department has defended these detentions in court. It's defended the global war framework under which it holds these detainees. And it has blocked any efforts to ensure remedy in the courts for these detainees. So it's a mixed bag of congressional and executive failure, and international law demands better. It demands solutions, not finger-pointing between the various branches of government.
Guantanamo detainees have been sent to many countries in the past, but this is the first time they've been sent to Ghana. Why is Ghana taking them in?
The US administration has been kind of, if you like, trawling the world for countries willing to take detainees. And it should be noted that the administration itself has welcomed Ghana's assistance, as it puts it, in closing the detention facility. But again, it needs to be pointed out that the US administration is expecting of other countries what it itself refuses to do, despite being the authority, the country, which created this problem in the first place. And that is that it refuses to take into the USA those detainees that it says it no longer needs to hold, but for which it has yet to find another country solution. So yes, many countries have kind of come, if you like, to the USA's assistance, and for that welcome their efforts. But the USA, again, is responsible for this and has not done what it could to end this human rights injustice.
Rob Freer from Amnesty International in London.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
Police in Zimbabwe have detained two journalists from a privately owned newspaper whom they say had published falsehoods. The two are to appear in court later today to defend a story about the payment of December salaries and bonuses to members of the Zimbabwean Secret Service. Now, whereas Secret Service members have received their salaries for December, other civil servants have gone empty-handed. Columbus Mafunga has the full story.
The arrest of Newsday deputy editor Ngawa Machazi and reporter Kolisani Ncube has attracted condemnation from rights groups and media watchdogs. Nhlanhla Ngwenya heads the Media Institute of Southern Africa, MISA in Zimbabwe. He says if the two arrested journalists from the privately owned daily had indeed written falsehoods, as the state claims, they should have been slapped with a civil charge and not a criminal charge.
It is completely unacceptable in a new constitutional dispensation that we have, which provides for media freedom, freedom of expression and access to information. In fact, the arrest says much more about the state than the media itself.
In December, Zimbabwe's cash-strapped government failed to pay its workers on time, with some of them only getting their pay in the first week of January after they had staged a demonstration. Zimbabwe Teachers Association's Chief Executive Officer Sifiso Ndlovu says workers would not listen to claims of bankrupts by President Mugabe's government.
This is a contractual issue. This is an obligation by one person, one party in employment. In as much as we want to be sympathetic, the same employer must be sympathetic to the worker who has failed to make ends meet. Look, the worker is depressed. He had a very gloomy Christmas. The worker has failed to send children to school. They cannot make ends meet. They are facing the wrath of sharks, and they're in the woods. So the similar thing must be felt by the government, sympathy to the worker.
Dewa Mavinga, a senior Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch, says President Mugabe, as the chairman of African Union, should not be seen to be promoting suppression of media freedom in Zimbabwe. That, Mavinga added, sets a bad tone for Africa.
What is happening also shows that there is a growing jittery approach by the police dealing with growing unrest on the back of deteriorating socioeconomic conditions. So the government of Zimbabwe should take this as a matter of serious consideration, that there is need to stem and avert civil unrest by addressing the plight of civil servants across the country, and also the need to respect the rights of journalists.
A Zimbabwe government official said on Thursday, the Newsday deputy editor Ngaba Machazi and reporter Kolisani Ncube would appear in court on Friday.
Columbus Mafhunga reporting.
Human rights.
This week, we look at the plight of hundreds of Nigerians who were freed from the clutches of the Islamist militant group Boko Haram late last year and are now sheltering in an open-air transit camp in Kolofata, a town in Cameroon close to the Nigerian border. Cameroon, along with Chad and Niger, has joined Nigeria in efforts to try and defeat Boko Haram. Our correspondent, Maki Kinseka, has been to the border camp and sends us this report.
Severe winds blow across this open-air transit camp in Sabongari, a northern border village in the town of Kolofata. This village is now home to about 800 Nigerians and internally displaced Cameroonians. Among the refugees is 56-year-old Dada Aminatu. She says she fled her village in the Nigerian town of Banki, less than 20 kilometers from Kolofata, when Cameroonian troops carried out continuous raids against Boko Haram strongholds early this month.
So many men, women and children escaped the shooting between the Cameroonian army and the Boko Haram fighters in our village. When Boko Haram fighters escaped, and some were either killed or arrested, those of us who survived asked the military to take us along for fear that the terrorist group may return to take revenge and kill us. Many of our people were killed during the fighting.
Cameroon says it has been working in cooperation with Nigerian troops to crush the terrorist group. Captain Kwemo Kletters, one of the senior commanders of Cameroon military, says they will continue the operations until Boko Haram is defeated.
We have been conducting regular patrols in these areas, in the villages at the border, and the situation is stable. We have at times some sporadic incursion of Boko Haram members there.
Besides the hundreds of Nigerians here at Sabongari, 800 more are arriving in Cameroon every week since Cameroonian and Nigerian troops started joint raids on Boko Haram strongholds along the border. Cameroon's Minister of Youth Affairs, Mununa Fotso, who visited the refugees, says the country is facing difficulties attending to their needs.
The humanitarian crisis here in Far North is very preoccupying, and displaced persons and refugees constitute a challenge for the government and its partners to come and visit and touch the reality on the field.
The coordinator of the United Nations system in Cameroon, Najat Rushdie, says scores of displaced persons and refugees have been seeking safer places in Cameroon out of the camps.
They have been supporting us since 2 years, and it was important for them also to have this direct contact with the population so they could hear from them. They could also realize what was done in terms of achievement regarding the assistance, and hopefully this is going to build the case for next year actually support.
The Boko Haram insurgency that is now in its sixth year has spilled over to Cameroon, Chad and Niger. According to the United Nations, more than 20,000 people have lost their lives and over 2 million have been displaced.
Maki Kinseka reporting. Next, we go to Guinea. Zainab Komancho Diallo is a Pearl poet engaged in promoting the culture of her Guinean ethnic group. She has opened a museum in Labe, the town where she was born. Her aim is to preserve traditional Pearl culture. But she is also a supporter of women's rights in a country where they are not always respected. This report by Galind Fulmer and Bob Barry is read now by Sela Oniko.
Assalamu alaikum.
Greetings are mostly exchanged in Arabic as Zainab Komancho Diallo travels through the Pearl region. She's here to talk farmers into handing over typical everyday life objects for her museum. It doesn't take long until she finds one.
She has kept a family heirloom which would fit nicely in our museum, a milk bowl made of fig wood. That's called a bourdougal in Pearl. Women use it for milking the cows.
To preserve traditional culture and pass it down to the younger generation. That is Madame Comancho's mission. 10 years ago, she returned to her birthplace, where she built the museum Labé, where Pearl artifacts and objects of everyday life are exhibited.
The Pearl culture in the Fouta Djallon region stands on three pillars: women, cows and religion. That shows that the Fouta Djallon culture has often given women a good place.
It's a poetry session at the museum's book discussion club. Here, young girls are encouraged to interpret, in their own way, traditional stories passed down by the Pearl. This is how they build up self-confidence in a male-dominated world. Girls like 17-year-old Dalanda Dieng, who enjoys poetry, explains why she likes coming to the museum.
I feel free when I declaim poetry. I really love our culture.
Islam is part of the Pearl culture. Zainab Komancho made the Hajj to Mecca in 2011 and even opened a Quranic school in her hometown. Here at the museum, young girls are taught their rights. Worldly and religious things are of equal importance. The museum is a kind of youth club. Young people can join debates and argue against established rituals in their society. Ramata Balde is only 14, but she has already learned the importance of taking a stand.
Two of my girlfriends married much too young. One was 13, the other 15. It made me so sad, but there was nothing I could do. Young girls here aren't allowed to have their say. We must listen to our elders. It's good to listen, but sometimes you also have to say no.
Some of the women have also learned that they can take up any jobs that were previously considered a male domain. Some of them want to be carpenters and earn their own living, which is a very unusual choice for women in this country. Zainab Komancho Diallo is there to help.
une bonne formation.
These girls are given a good training. They didn't follow their grandmothers, who refused to take up professions for men. They work just like the men and get their diplomas.
Elles sont diplômées.
And that report was written by Gellin Fulmer and Bob Barry.
Your C.
And this is the point in the programme where you, the listener, tell us what you think of the stories we've been covering this week. We now join Abubakar Jolu and Eunice Wanjuru.
We would like to begin by thanking you, our dear listeners, for the wonderful New Year wishes we've received from you.
That's right. A very big thank you to you all, and also for your opinion and feedback in the rest of 2015. We are looking forward to hearing more from you in 2016. And be sure that we will continue to air your opinion every Friday here on Africa Link.
We start in Kenya, where Garissa University reopened on Monday 4th. Garissa University, which is located 150 kilometers from the Somali border, was attacked by Al-Shabaab gunmen 9 months ago. And 148 people were killed, most of them being students.
The university has reopened its doors to students and staff, with classes commencing on January the 11th. There has been some reactions on this.
Right. Under the hashtag Garissa University Reopens, Kenyan Twitter users have been stating their support for the reopening of the campus. Some say that the event is a sign that Kenyans are standing up against the threat of terrorism. Hamza Noor said, "Terrorism is defeated. Let's move forward and build a beautiful Kenya."
And we also have this response from Ahmed Mohammed, who said that as the university reopens, bravery was being redefined. He also added that the pen is mightier than the gun. The move to reopen the university was welcomed throughout Kenya and has been trending on social media.
Well, let's now look at the visit of Christine Lagarde, Managing Director of the International Monetary Fund, IMF, to Nigeria on January the 5th. She held talks with economic experts, ministers and leading industry figures, as well as meeting Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari.
Oh yes, that did make news in the rest of sub-Saharan Africa. Her visit came at a time where Nigeria's economy is facing serious challenges. Usman Bin Affan, a student at the University of Maiduguri in northeast Nigeria, thinks Lagarde's visit to Nigeria is very timely.
He does indeed, and Usman goes on to say that Nigeria has to wake up and boost other ways of getting income, not only depending on petroleum, which has no guarantee. He goes on and adds that measures have to be taken to boost the agricultural and industrial sector to provide employment opportunities for the unemployed youth.
And last but not least, Aliyu Muhammad from Yobe State in Nigeria also seems positive about Lagarde's visit to his country. He said that this visit will encourage foreign investors and experts to invest in the country. Nigerians are eager to see what impact this will actually have to make.
And that's all we had for this week's USA.
Eunice Wanjuru and Abubakar Jolo, many thanks. And remember, you too can comment on the stories we cover here on Africa Link or on our website, dw.com/Africa. Just send a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110 Bonn, Germany, and email to feedback.africa@dw.com or a text message to 49 160 957 59510. And before we go, let me give you the provisional results of the presidential elections in the Central African Republic. The two candidates who garnered the most votes were Fusta Achange Touadéra, who polled 19.4%, and Anicet Georges Dologela, who won 23.7%. Those two will be vying for the presidency in a runoff on January the 31st, in just over 3 weeks' time. Those provisional results have yet to be confirmed by the Constitutional Court. There we end another week here on Africa Link. Crispin Mwahideo will be here on Monday. Do join him if you can. Until the next time, this is Mark Caldwell in Bonn.